just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Real minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, November 10th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Murder in the name of honor. We'll speak with journalist Rana Hosseini, the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and American Indians fight to end the slaughter of bison. Plus this week's Empire Notes. But I can't help myself, why should I? This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Yesterday marked the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall, symbolizing the end of communist power and the beginning of the reunification of Germany. The wall was a separation created between East and West Berlin as a result of the agreement between the four post-World War II Allied powers, the Americans, British, French, and the Soviet Union. After concerted grassroots resistance, the East German leadership announced on November 9, 1989, that East Germans would be allowed to travel freely to the West. That night, tens of thousands of Germans from both sides gathered and crossed the wall, picking apart pieces of it. The wall was eventually removed altogether, and now many parts of it are enshrined in museums across the world. Yesterday's anniversary was marked with world leaders participating in ceremonies and thousands of Berliners and tourists flocking to the streets of the city. But in the context of today's global recession, what can be said about the promise of capitalism? And what of the walls that exist today, such as the U.S.-Mexico border, the so-called separation wall in the Palestinian territories, and how did Germans feel after all these years? Joining us to help answer some of these questions is Victor Grossman. He's an American journalist and author and a resident of East Berlin for many years. He's the author of Crossing the River, a memoir of the American left, the Cold War, and life in East Germany. Welcome to Uprising, Victor.
Yes, good evening. Good morning to you there.
Good morning.
Good evening here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, can you describe what the sentiment was yesterday, and I'm sure still all week this week, in Berlin, and what are some of the reflections that you've been hearing about what happened 20 years ago?
Well, first of all, there were, as you said, thousands and thousands at Brandenburg Gate, the central part of the city. They had all kinds of famous speakers, statesmen, they had music, they had fireworks. It was dampened by bad weather, it was pretty bad weather, but the people who were there, to judge by the TV interviews, were in a very good mood nevertheless and rejoiced, and many of them recalled the days 20 years ago when they crossed over for the first time. But, of course, there were other views too, which I've heard today.
And what were some of the alternative views?
Well, not everybody is happy at what happened after the war went down. In fact, it's often referred to in East Germany not as German unification, but as West German annexation or even colonization, because the economy in East Germany took a nosedive after the two joined, East and West joined, a terrible nosedive, which is still happening. In other words, there's been a critical period ever since, and some very good things happened, some very wonderful things for many people happened, but there were lots of things which weren't. That's why one woman I met today said she was happy it rained last night.
Now, I'm wondering if the critique is, as you said, more about what happened after the wall fell, but not necessarily that the wall fell. I mean, are there Germans who wish that the physical wall was still up?
I don't know. There was a general euphoria in the air. Almost everybody was happy to see it go down. Well, there were exceptions, because there were some people who were very much committed to trying to maintain, to keep, to save the East German, the German Democratic Republic, as it was called, were trying to save it, were hoping to save it, who had, didn't like West Germany and who saw this as the beginning of the end, which is what it was. So those people who were a definite minority were not so happy.
Victor, I want to play for you and our listeners some audio from November 1989 that was recorded right near the wall by Bill Thomas. It's a piece called Conversation at an Open Wall, and it's been preserved in the Pacifica Radio Archives since 1989. We hear the producer, Bill Thomas, interviewing Germans and foreigners near the wall following the opening of the border between East and West Germany. Let's take a listen.
Later, the same day as I spoke to all the chippers and sightseers, we met with Michael Herder, the head of Künstlerhaus Britannia, a wonderful center in West Berlin, oriented toward working artists. After much discussion about art and artists over coffee and pastries in his office, we had to ask him, too, about the reunification of the West and the East. His comments echo those of many, many German progressives or liberals, people on the left.
We will come to a new definition, an old definition of a new Europe, or an old definition of a new Europe, as you might see it as you want to. Anyway, an idea of a new Europe, which is an open Europe, a cultural Europe. And we have to be aware of the dangers of the strong powers in Europe to take over and define a Europe which we do not like, we do not want to have. We would like to have a Europe of strong regional powers and forces, cultural forces. The market is one thing, and there must be supranational organizations dealing with that. There must be a harmonization of many things, but not the cultural side of it. And we must really be aware that this gets, again, a very strong impact in Europe, East and West, and that we can learn from each other. So I'm, as I think many people in the cultural field, not at all in favor of a reunification, I don't think. The word, anyway, is nonsense to me, because they will no be a re back to anything we have had before. But a unification is not what I imagine to be the best possible way of two different German sides of one nation to develop. And I think we should hope that the people in the GDR have the chance really to develop their own way of democracy, their own way of state organization, their own way of dealing with economy and with capitalism, and that we can maybe in some time learn from them.
When asked, what if the people in the East don't want to go their own way? What if they want to join you? Herr Herder replied,
well, that's possible, yeah. I don't know. There are, I think, strong forces which are going in the opposite direction, sure. On both sides, on the side of the Federal Republic as well as in GDR.
Well, uncertainty was the order of the day. Of course, as you know by now, things moved much faster than most of the people I presented you with had hoped.
And that's the voice of Bill Thomas, who recorded a short documentary called Conversations at an Open Wall in Berlin in November 1989, just days and weeks after the fall of the Berlin Wall, which we are discussing today, a day after the 20th anniversary. He was speaking to a left-leaning thinker who wasn't as optimistic as perhaps some of the voices that were heard in the mainstream press at the time, and certainly some of the voices and words that we've been reading in the mainstream press today. My guest is Victor Grossman, joining me live from East Berlin. He's an American journalist and author. He's lived in East Berlin for many years. He's written Crossing the River, a memoir of the American left, the Cold War, and life in East Germany. Victor, from listening to some of the words of this gentleman 20 years ago, do you think, judging us also by what you said to me earlier, that not all was happy and joyful yesterday, that some people had a sense that capitalism was not going to, or the capitalist infusion with democracy was not necessarily going to save East Germany?
Yes, an awful lot of people who were very, very happy 20 years ago to join friends or relatives, to be able to travel, to have all kinds of commodities, which were always, there was always enough here, but lots of commodities were missing, which they liked. They soon found out the other side of it, which meant that hundreds of thousands of people were thrown out of work, including half of the people in academia were thrown out because they had taught in old GDR. All offices, all newspapers, all radio and TV, they immediately fired virtually the entire staff. They changed the entire TV and radio program, which people had grown used to. And there was a conscious policy of ruining the economy, breaking down not only the decrepit old factories, of which there were many, but very modern, super modern, state-of-the-art factories were also closed down because they were competition, so that an awful lot of people suffered. I think a majority lost their jobs. Now today, by the way, the same was true in the cultural field. All the books that had been published in the old GDR, including art books and travel books, they were thrown in the garbage heap. Cultural things closed down, they became expensive. Today, of course, those people who have good jobs are more or less happy about it because they do get good pay. They can travel where they want. They can buy anything they want if they have the money. But others who don't have good jobs are suffering, and there's a terrific lack of security. This is one thing that the GDR had, aside from all the bad sides of the old GDR, which made people happy to see it go down. There were many good sides, which people took for granted before they lost them. Everybody had a job. No one was afraid of losing a job. You couldn't be evicted, so there was no homelessness. You never saw a beggar. You never saw people who couldn't afford to get new teeth. There was complete security from an economic point of view, of course, which today is missing. And that's why many people have been rethinking their joy of those days, not wanting to go back to the way it was, because that was impossible anyway, but dissatisfied with the present system, where some big shot sitting up in a skyscraper, either in Frankfurt Main or maybe in the GM building in Detroit or in the Nokia in Helsinki, they can decide, we'll close that factory down, throw out 10,000 people, throw 3,000 out there, as if they're playing Monopoly. And that means terrible disaster for people. After a year, they become basically paupers. Mm. So that a lot of people have been doing rethinking and have been voting for a left-wing party more and more, which has got the people, even those who were there at the gate yesterday celebrating. I think they have a sort of, in the back of their mind, they're a little worried, because people, especially in the old East Germany, but now increasingly in West Germany as well, are beginning to rethink the whole matter and saying, yeah, the change was not only for the better, and we have to think of some new way. With much of what we lost in the GDR, with what we gained, so that there's a lot of rethinking going on in the whole country.
I'm speaking with Victor Grossman, live from East Berlin, who is an American journalist and author, and we're talking about the fall of the Berlin Wall one day after the 20th anniversary of that momentous occasion. And Victor, I'm wondering if you think that comparisons between the Berlin Wall and the Separation Wall, many call it the Apartheid Wall in the Palestinian territories, even the U.S.-Mexico border, and so many other walls that are still up today, are those apt analogies?
Well, of course, they're different in the sense that with the one on the Mexican border, it's to keep people from coming in, whereas the wall in Berlin was basically to keep people from leaving. The GDR authorities were afraid of the brain drain, which was very, very severe. People could go to Western Germany. It wasn't like Mexicans coming to the United States. It was the same country, basically, the same language. And they were offered all kinds of good jobs and even lured away, so that it was to keep people basically in. However, there are analogies. By the way, as for Palestine, it's a different situation. Also, it's not a question of keeping people out there. It's a question. There are similarities in that walls are no damn good wherever they are. But I wouldn't. I would hesitate to make it too easy an analogy. By the way, people argue about those issues here very much today in Germany now about the wall in Palestine. There's a sharp division of opinion. Many are very horrified by such things as the wall or the war in Gaza. Others are not. But in terms of the Berlin Wall, it was a different situation, except for one thing that is interesting that it did keep out. It did keep out the Nazis. Before the wall went down, you never saw a demonstration of marching Nazis, real like old stormtroopers from the old Hitler days. Now you see it in 10, 20 towns and cities around Germany every weekend. They passed me 2 weeks ago on this, right near my home. I went down there. These black men and women in black clothing, shouting just like under Hitler. It was a very frightening experience. There were lots of anti-fascists too. There always are. That's the good side. Usually the majority are the anti-fascists who try to block them and oppose them. But this is an alarming development, although there are not so many of them now in number. They don't get too many votes. But still, these Nazis were kept out. And what was also kept out, those big companies, huge companies, and banks, who were the same ones who built up Hitler back in the 1920s and the 1930s, and who pretty well ruled the economy, and they were thrown out of East Germany in 1945. They've all come back, and they're moving eastward. They're trying to take over. They've taken over East Germany, but they're also going to Poland, to the Czech Republic, to Romania, so that there are certain similarities with the past which really have people worried and alarmed, at least some people.
Victor Grossman, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and really sort of giving us an alternative look at this very important anniversary. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and best wishes to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Victor Grossman is an American journalist and author, a resident of East Berlin for many years, where he's just joined us live from there. He's the author of Crossing the River, a memoir of the American left, the Cold War, and life in East Germany. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for providing the audio clip that we heard earlier. We're going to continue our coverage of the fall of the Berlin Wall with this week's Empire Notes. After that, part one of a two-part interview with a Jordanian journalist and women's rights activist, Rana Husseini, and we'll also hear about the struggle of American Indians to end the slaughter of bison. Stay tuned. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and The New Crusade. Today's commentary is about the fall of the Berlin Wall.
The Bengalis, my mother's people, have a saying. Anyone who isn't a communist at 20 has no heart. Anyone who still is a communist at 40 has no brain. Unpleasantly redolent of the complacency of age, of the status quo, and of capitalism as it is, it's still worth considering. I was 20 when the Berlin Wall fell. I was in the middle of a brief flirtation with anarchism at the time, brought on by my first reading of Chomsky. Like many young leftists, I found it liberating. Actually existing communism had produced societies that were nightmares of stultification. The Warsaw Pact countries in particular had no trace of romance or revolution to leaven the image of dull gray lives led by dull gray people made that way by a dull gray system. At the time, we were mystified by the anger and despair of the older generation. To us, it betokened a kind of totemic identification with societies and systems because of past connections and because of reflexive verbal associations with terms like socialism and collective. Surely, these countries had no more to do with real socialism than Stalin did with real Bolshevism, or the Holocaust and the Inquisition with real Christianity. The dethroning of Erich Honecker or Todor Zhivkov didn't change the inherent evils of capitalism and imperialism, or the importance of a real alternative. No sooner were such thoughts formulated, of course, than they were drowned in a welter of Western triumphalism. In some ways, perhaps the older generation was wiser. They saw that, rather than a blow for human freedom, the fall of communism would be a loss for one side and a victory for the other. Many of them even realized that the dissociation of actual socialism from real socialism, that Platonic ideal form, was a little too facile. We've now lived through 20 years, my entire adult life, of a world with, as Margaret Thatcher correctly pointed out, no alternatives. We have seen the results. The monstrous tragedies of communism that billions lived through became for the United States nothing more than retrospective justification for its own crimes and follies, and cheap fodder for a new global offensive, this one unchecked by the existence of another pole, ideological, political, or military. Perhaps we've gained enough distance to evaluate this brief interlude in the history of the world. It's true we still have China, Cuba, Vietnam, and North Korea with us, and a lot of noise from Hugo Chavez, but the term of communism as a living idea in the world began in 1871 with the Paris Commune and ended in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. What can we say about it? It's true, of course, that the history of communism is one continually thwarted by imperialist reaction and bloodshed, by the machinations of unscrupulous power-hungry intellectuals, and by the rise of a bloodless bureaucratic elite, who played no part in the revolutions but took for themselves the best of what their societies produced. There are deeper truths, though. Michael Albert connects the evils of actually existing communism to the rise of what he calls coordinatorism, the ideology of a new class defined ideologically by their role in dictating to society what it should do, rather than economically by their role in production. I think it goes deeper. It's long been a staple of the conservative critique of communism that the very existence of a utopian ideology of social transformation itself inevitably leads to catastrophe. It is not just Nazism and communism. The post-war creators of the American Empire, who evolved an ideological worldview that James Peck has termed visionary globalism, shared the same problem in lesser degree. The other critique, that communism removed self-interest and thus initiative, certainly did not apply to the builders of the system. Those revolutionaries, dictators, apparatchiks, and political entrepreneurs were engaged in a tremendous act of will. They shook the pillars of heaven and tried to force the pace of history, all the while proclaiming that they were in the service of historical inevitability. They weren't all, or even mostly, evil or purely self-serving. What united them, though, the ones that survived or succeeded, was a shared belief that they must use whatever degree of ruthlessness was required to achieve the dictates of history. There is a new left in the world that wishes to disavow any connection with that history of heroism, sacrifice, folly, and destruction, that wishes not to impose a cost on anyone, and much of which also doesn't wish to bear any. How will it avoid the mistakes of the past and also avoid the comfort and moral safety of powerlessness? How will it unite the head and the heart without forgetting the hand? For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mann.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Every year, an estimated 5,000 women are killed by so-called crimes of honor. It is a practice that links a woman's sexuality and often virginity to the honor of her family and entire community. For more than 15 years, Jordanian journalist and women's rights activist Rana Hosseini has dedicated her life to uncovering the stories of violence against women and helped to veer both legal and cultural traditions away from this barbaric practice. Her work has led her to discover that so-called honor killings happen all over the world, contrary to the belief that they're restricted to the Arab and Muslim world. In countries like Italy, the UK, Brazil, and right here in the US, violence against women stemming from jealousy, male entitlement, family honor, and other patriarchal structures is far more prevalent than most of us realize. Rana Hosseini has captured the stories of many of these women and her work in their support in a new book called Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. I spoke with her for an extended interview, and today we'll play you part one of our two-part interview. Rana Hosseini begins by reading to us from her book.
Chapter 1. Murder in Amman. In summer, the temperature in Jordan soars to the unpleasantly high 30s. Across the sweltering capital, those of Amman's citizens who were fortunate enough not to have to make their living on the teeming street hid away from the sun in the city's many coffee shops. It was 31st May 1994. The day that Kifaya's mother, uncles, and brothers had decided she should die. In the built-up part of the conservative old city, Kifaya sat, tied to a chair in the kitchen of her family home. The sweets that her older brother Khalid had brought earlier to persuade her that everything was all right lay untouched on the counter. Kifaya's crime was to have allowed herself to be raped by her other brother Muhammad. She had then been forced by her family secretly to abort his child and had been made to marry a man 34 years her senior, whom she had divorced after 6 miserable months. She had shamed her family. There was only one solution. Khaled held a glass to Kifaya's lips and told her to drink some water. He asked her to recite verses from the Quran and picked up a knife. Kifaya begged for mercy. Outside, the neighbors listened but did not do anything as she started to scream.
Rana Husseini, a Jordanian journalist, reading from her book, Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. Rana, this story of Kifaya that you relate is the first incident that you came across of the so-called honor crimes in Jordan, began your journey that led you to writing this book many years later. Describe what motivated you to take up this cause as a journalist, but in a way also as an advocate.
Well, you know, this story was really horrific because it was a small news item in the newspaper of a woman who was killed, or a child who was killed by her brother. There was no other details. So when I went to disclose the murder or investigate it, let's start all over, okay? I don't know what's wrong with me. It's the first time. I'm usually very...
That's okay. You look a little tired.
I'm usually very smooth on this. Okay. What motivated me was really this story of Kifaya, a girl who I've never met in my life. I just read a small item in the paper of a child who was killed by her brother, and I went to investigate the matter, and I discovered a horrific story. This girl, as I read, she was raped by her brother. He tried to kill her. She underwent a secret abortion. Then they married her to a man 34 years older than her, and then 6 months later, they killed her, the family, blaming her for the rape. And when I went to talk to the uncles, they basically accused her of seducing her brothers and blamed her entirely for the rape. To me, this was really a shock. It was a sad story of a 16-year-old girl who went through these horrible things through her short life. And I reported the story for the Jordan Times, and the following day, an intellectual Jordanian woman called the newspaper screaming and yelling at my editors that they should stop me from reporting these crimes because this is not us and this doesn't happen in our society. So I became even more enraged that the call came from a woman, and I decided to show her and show everyone else that, no, this is us, this is our society, we have problems and we have to face it. At that time, really no one was reporting about these murders. And I just came across one story after another, and it was really shocking. And I decided that I wanted to register and document each and every case I hear about, and to be the voice of these women. Then I went to the courts, and I discovered that men who killed their sisters were getting away with very lenient sentences, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, for taking their female relatives' lives, whereby you can write a bad check and get a higher sentence for that. So this was, to me, another shock at that time, you know, but, of course, things change now. So I said also I'm going to focus on the courts, and the newspapers also never focused on the court verdicts. And later on, I went to the prison to do a story about women in prison. And I was shocked to learn that there are many women who are imprisoned indefinitely for their own safety because their family wants to kill them for reasons related to family honor. And I've met some women who have been there for over 10 years, wasting their youth, just sitting there. They cannot release themselves. And the only way for them to be released is if their a family member comes to bail them out. And usually it's to kill them. So basically, these were the three things that motivated me to do what I was doing. And of course, until the first three or 4 years of my career, I was just thinking that I was just a journalist documenting these cases. I wanted people to hear. I wanted people, our readers, to react. I wanted the government to do something. I thought I was just documenting these cases and reporting them for the public. But in 1998, I was nominated for the Reebok Human Rights Award. And this award is given to four individuals in the world who are 30 years or younger, who work on human rights issues. And when I came here to the U.S. to receive it, I discovered that I was actually not only a journalist, but I was also a human rights activist. And this is how the journey started.
So, Rana, one of the things that you show in your book is that part of the lack of media coverage had been also due to the fact that the media coverage itself can serve to malign the victim, the girl, and the way in which she might have, you know, quote, stained the honor of her family. First of all, how prevalent is that in the media, and has that aspect of sort of media coverage changed as your work has opened more people's eyes?
Of course, yeah. When I first started, this issue was considered taboo. The media did not want to talk about it, specifically the Arabic media. Of course, the Jordan Times was very supportive. The editors, everyone believed in this issue and other human rights issues. And as I said, in the beginning, it was really difficult for the media to tackle it. First of all, some reporters in the Arabic press believed women deserve to die. Others said they don't want to meddle, and this is like a family issue. They don't want to get in trouble, or they don't want to report about it. But after all the work that we have done in Jordan, that's also documented in my book, and the activities and the awareness we have raised and the media coverage of our activities in the late 90s, really this broke the taboo forever, I think. And now it's very normal to talk about the issue. Some of the Arabic papers are now reporting the crime itself and the verdict. And these are important, you know, elements, because this was a problem in the past when we used to talk, oh, you're exaggerating, these murders do not happen. But now they are reporting each and every case. Some Arabic newspapers, they're documenting the cases just as we used to do in the Jordan Times. And this is an eye-opener for people, and they're putting details of the murders. So this is something very important. In addition, you know, for the longest, I think, for over 6 or 7 years now, the Jordanian media has been focusing a lot on violence against women and children, talking to experts, writing features, journalists, talking to religious leaders, talking to victims. And this we did not see when I first started. This issue of violence against women and children was rarely, and sexual molestation and so forth, and rape. It was very rare to see in the media. And now we see it a lot, and you see people react. Now, you know, because of the internet, people post their opinion. We have even electronic newspapers that are different than the local dailies, and they also write, and people react. It's not like the best reaction sometimes, and sometimes there are people who say, no, this does not, shouldn't happen. And I feel that there's now more voices growing against these crimes in Jordan. And I think it's all because of all the awareness that we have done, the involvement of the civil society, even the royal family, the government. Mm-hmm. Everyone got involved at one point, and really this helped a lot.
So, Rana, you talk about violence against women and children as a very broad thing. And here in the West, the media does tend to focus very much on the so-called honor crimes, the very dramatic and tragic killings of women that families decide have to be done to salvage their honor when the woman is raped or committed adultery or whatever. But how important is it to broaden the discussion to violence against women and children?
Yeah, you're right. I think, I mean, this is one thing wherever I go, I'm calling for. I think we have to address violence against women and children from a global perspective. We should not pinpoint a certain country, a certain religion, a certain nation, because violence against women is an international phenomenon. One in three women in the world would be subjected to some form of violence at one point in her time, according to UN figures. In the past, it was one in four. Now it's one in three. If you want to talk about homicide figures, in the U.S., the Ministry of Justice, I met with women from who are in charge of the domestic violence unit, and they had figures of 2 years ago of about 1,300 women being killed in the U.S. by their partners. That's three women every day.
Yeah, we don't call those honor crimes, but I mean, in a way, they're part of the same problem.
Exactly. And that's why, I mean, killing of women is killing of women regardless if it's honor, if it's jealousy, if it's possessiveness, if it's revenge. At the end of the day, women are being killed everywhere in the world.
And in your book, you cite a figure, I believe it was 5,000 specifically categorized as these honor crimes around the world, and not just in the Middle East or Muslim countries, but all over the world.
True. This is like UN estimates that were done in 2000. Unfortunately, I think the number is much higher than 5,000, and I think the number now is much higher than that. But again, 5,000, 10,000, one woman, it's too much. We have to always say we have to constantly address the issue of violence against women, raise awareness. Centers that help women, they should always be, announcing their presence, offering their hotlines, because there are a lot of women who are in danger or who are abused, who think they are alone. And this is one of the reasons that I put a lot of cases in my book. I want it to be like a warning sign for women who might think they are living in a safe environment, to know that they are not to be careful, to seek guidance, never to be afraid. If you are afraid and you think that you cannot do anything, you will lose your life. You have to stand up and fight for your life, seek help. Help is there in all countries now. All countries realize, even the conservative countries, they realize that this is a problem, and they have centers, they have people who help, they have hotlines. So this is really, I want it to be like an empowering tool for women to be able to realize that they can seek help. They are not alone.
I'm speaking with journalist and activist Rana Hosseini, whose book is called Murder in the Name of Honor, The True Story of One Woman's Heroic Fight Against an Unbelievable Crime. She joins me in studio to talk about violence against women. So you mentioned around the world, I mean, this is a phenomenon that is global, but even honor crimes, you said that in the UK and in the US and immigrant communities, you even cited in your book Brazil and Ecuador.
And Italy.
And Italy. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, based on my research and research done by organizations such as Equality Now, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty, they documented murders happening in other countries, not only the Islamic world. Unfortunately, a lot of people try to attribute these murders to a certain religion, to a certain nation. For example, in Jordan, I wrote about 5 or 6 Christian women who were killed in a so-called honor crime throughout my 16-year career. There's a report of many Christian women who were killed in our part of the world and elsewhere. In Italy, there were 2 men recently who killed their sisters in Sicily, Italian men, because they tarnished their family's honor. The same in South America. There are a lot of countries that still use the notion of honor when issuing verdicts
right.
for men who kill women for such reasons or infidelity or so forth. Again, in countries like in Iraq, there was an incident of a Yazidi woman who was killed. She was stoned to death. Yazidi faith is nothing. It has nothing to do with Islam or mm-hmm. Christianity. Again, in Afghanistan, Pakistan,
there are reports
of these murders happening within all the religious faiths there, Hindu, Sikhs. So really, it's not. That's why I always say we have to address it from a global perspective, because I think at the end of the day, it's all about power. It's all about wanting to control women, possessing women. Be it honor, be it a woman wanting to leave her husband or abusive partner or so forth. There was an unfortunate incident of this woman, Indian woman, Sikh woman, who was living in the UK, and she was married to a Sikh man, of course, and she wanted to leave him because he was abusive. And eventually they killed her. They took her, they lured her back to India and killed her because she wanted to leave her husband. And you hear many, many, many cases. Once I was in the UK, and this man killed his wife and stuffed her in a bag. He's a British man, just because she wanted to leave them. Mm. Imagine the gruesome. And there are thousands, unfortunately, thousands and thousands of stories of women who get killed or violently abused by their partners, spouses, husbands, or family members.
Rana,
just either because they are women or because they want to make a choice in their life or because, you know, they want to leave.
Now, you brought up early on in our interview and also in your book very much part of the problem has been the court system and the problem of accountability. It still is the fact in many countries that when men can show that they committed the crime in a fit of passion, they get a much more lenient sentence. Give us the case example of Jordan and how things have changed in the court system today and whether that's made a big impact.
Yeah, I think in most countries, let's say of our part of the world, the problem is always with the application of the law.
Mm-hmm.
Laws exist to protect women somehow, but most of the judges are men, and most of the judges come from conservative backgrounds and feel that it's the woman's fault. You know, you still have this idea. It's almost here in this part of the world when a woman gets raped, they put the blame on her. But the thing, what happened in Jordan is the government in the late 90s suggested amending an article in the penal code which talks about adultery, and if a man finds his wife or female relative committing adultery with another man and kills or injures one or both, he's exempted from punishment. And the second clause, if they are found in an adultery situation and he kills one or both, he benefits from a reduction. So the government scrapped the first article and kept the exemption and gave the same right to women if they find their husbands in the marriage bed committing adultery with another woman. Of course, this was not our intention we don't want to justify a murder by any, you know, in the legal system, not to give anyone the excuse to get away with the murder. But this is what happened back then. This, along with our activity, we formed a group. We were called the Jordan National Committee to Eliminate So-Called Honor Crimes. We adopted the government's amendments, although I was not 100% that this is the right thing, because there's another article, as you said, that talks about the fit of fury, whereby if a person kills another person because of an unlawful or dangerous act on the part of the victim in a moment of rage, he benefits from a reduction. And this is where most of the killers were getting away with this in Jordan. The court considers a woman's behavior, sexual conduct, challenging her family as an or going missing or becoming pregnant out of wedlock as a dangerous and unlawful act. That gives the defendant a reduction in penalty. So if the charge is premeditated, it becomes a misdemeanor. Imagine, from death penalty or life in prison to 1 year or 6 months. So basically, this is what I've been focusing on for the longest time. Now, recently, the government, they're trying to change this article and increase the punishment. But unfortunately, we are faced with a conservative lower house of parliament that really believed from the beginning that all what we did was backed up by the West. It's unfortunate they couldn't see that there was a civil movement going on. And this is always like all human rights all over the world activists, they get accused of being Western agents.
Of course.
Yeah. But the good thing is that now the government is more aware. I mean, this year in specific in Jordan, you've had the Minister of Justice, you've had the government spokesperson, even the Queen, the King, they all spoke against violence against women. They did specify so-called honor killings. In July of this year, the criminal court specifically designated a special tribunal to try people who kill in a so-called honor crime, you know, and they kill in the name of family honor. And just when I was here in the U.S. on October 13, they issued the longest sentence ever based on my work experience. They handed a man a 15-year prison sentence for killing his sister for reasons related to family honor. They did not consider the fit of fury argument. And the most important thing is they rejected the family's request to drop charges. Usually what happens, if a man is sentenced to 15, family drops charges, it becomes 7.5. If it's 2 years, it becomes 1 year. If it's 1 year, it becomes 6 months. Wow. If it's 6 months, it becomes 3 months. So the court, and then after a week after that, they issued another sentence, similar one with 15 years. So I think this is a very important improvement. It shows really that the government, even the leadership of the country, is really serious about wanting to curb these, to fight these problems and, you know, hopefully reducing. It's unfortunate you cannot end these crimes, but at least reducing it. You know, changing the law is one thing, but you have to work on many things. You have to on changing the attitude, improving the education system, encouraging religious leaders and community leaders to speak out against this problem. The press has to continuously address it. So it's a combination of things. It's not only one thing that will help.
My guest is Rana Hosseini, a Jordanian journalist and women's rights activist and author of the book Murder in the Name of Honor, the true story of one woman's heroic fight against an unbelievable crime. You've been listening to part one of our two-part interview. Tune in tomorrow at the same time to hear the second part. After today's subversive historian, environmental and native groups sue over a mass slaughter of bison. Stay tuned.
In a Veterans Day call for peace, the unembedded, award-winning independent journalist who repeatedly risked his life to bring the truth of the occupation of Iraq to us all, Dar Jamal, will offer a powerful, up-to-the-minute presentation in Ventura. His broad-ranging topic, from Iraq to Afghanistan, the media, the military, and the new GI resistance, will be given on Veterans Day, Wednesday, November 11th, at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church, located at 5654 Ralston Street in the city of Ventura. The event will also feature an art exhibit by veterans, including the Combat Paper Project, artwork created on paper made from their own uniforms. More information about this Veterans Day event is available at 805-407-7997 or at kpfk.org. That's 805-407-7997 or kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on November 10, 1898, the Wilmington race riots occurred in North Carolina. At least 22 blacks were killed by racist white members of the Democratic Party as a municipal coup d'etat was staged. Emboldened by a post-Reconstruction general election that brought the party back into power in the state legislature, former Confederate Alfred Moore Waddell led a mob to oust the white Republican mayor of Wilmington as well as black and white members of city government. Neither President McKinley nor the governor of North Carolina did anything to stop the profoundly violent, racist, and anti-democratic usurpation of power. The late historian John Hope Franklin had this to say about the relevancy of the Wilmington race riots.
The Wilmington race riot is very relevant today because we haven't changed as much as we need to change.
That was John Hope Franklin. And for Uprising, this is your truth professor, saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Millions of wild bison once roamed North America before being nearly wiped out in the late 19th century as the U.S. government attempted to force Native Americans onto reservations. Today, the largest concentration of bison remains in the Yellowstone National Park region at a mere 3,000 in number. Now, a coalition of environmental and Native American groups filed suit on Monday to halt the slaughter of bison. The National Park Service and the Forest Service were the two federal agencies named and accused of mismanaging the endangered bison population in an effort that wastes millions of dollars annually. During the last decade, more than 3,300 bison were shipped to slaughter by the federal agencies in collaboration with the state of Montana. In 2008 alone, 1,400 bison were captured and killed. The reason given for the population control measures is that free-roaming bisons are thought to be a risk factor in spreading the brucellosis disease to cattle. The lawsuit contends that the threat of transmission has been widely overstated and cites an independent study in backing its claims. Rosebud Sioux tribal elder and plaintiff in the suit, Rosalie Little Thunder, called the bison policies of the federal agencies, quote, an affront to indigenous peoples and an abrogation of the government's trust responsibilities. My guest is Stephanie C. She's a media coordinator for the Buffalo Field Campaign. Welcome to Uprising, Stephanie.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us. So first, what is the main reason why Native American groups and environmental groups are interested in this issue, and what is the main basis for your lawsuit?
Well, the main interest in our joining this lawsuit is because we care about wild bison. Wild bison are a keystone species. They once basically blanketed the continent, and they are very important ecologically to a variety of plant and animal species. And unfortunately, we only have fewer than 3,000 wild bison remaining in the United States, the Yellowstone population. And the state of Montana and the federal government have been working together to prevent wild bison from restoring themselves on their native land by killing them, harassing them year after year, spending federal tax money, and just disrupting the ecosystem. We are in filing this lawsuit because we feel that the federal agencies involved, explicitly the National Park Service via Yellowstone National Park and the U.S. Forest Service via Gallatin National Forest, are failing in their mandates to, one, protect resources, i.e. bison, unimpaired for future generations, and they are failing to provide habitat for wild bison, which is the Forest Service is mandated to do for native wildlife species. So we are bringing these agencies to the court, and we hope to force them to do what they are supposed to be doing, which is to protect and conserve wild populations of native wildlife, the bison, and to provide them habitat on our public lands.
So there are historic and contemporary reasons for the slaughter of bison. Let's first talk about the historic reasons. I mentioned that in the late 19th century, the United States government attempted to force Native Americans onto reservations, and at the same time was when wild bison were nearly wiped out. So what was the motivation there?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the government and the westward expansionists knew that the bison and the native people of this continent were intrinsically connected, that one depended upon the other, and the government felt that if they could clear the land of the bison, then they could subjugate the native people, and the people that thought that they could make a living off of bringing cattle into the country wanted nothing more than to get wild bison off of the landscape as well. So it was a two-fold effort, and unfortunately, they almost succeeded. And fortunately, bison and native people are stronger than that harmful arm of the government, and we still have a small population of bison left. But today, the cattle industry, back in the late 1900s or early 1900s, brought a disease with their cattle called brucellosis, and they infected native wildlife, such as bison and elk, with the disease. It doesn't really have much of an impact on the wildlife other than the politics that's behind it. The cattle industry wants control over the land. They want control over the grass and who gets to eat it, and they are using brucellosis as an excuse to maintain control, but in essence, this whole issue is about the grass and who gets to eat it.
So you're talking about grazing lands, which, of course, the cattle industry is very much interested in having lots of.
Exactly.
So
the interesting thing is where the bison are roaming currently, there are no cattle. So, you know, the question is always, you know, what is the problem? Why can't bison roam here? There's no cattle present. What's the issue? And we really feel that the government and the cattle industry fear the return of the bison because it would set a precedent and it would show that wild bison are more than capable of restoring themselves on the landscape, and that is the last thing that the cattle industry wants to have happen.
So wild roaming bison that find themselves outside of the confines of the Yellowstone National Park, those are the ones that are targeted in general?
Yes, exactly. The majority of the population lives within Yellowstone National Park, especially during the summer months when the grass is very green and plentiful, but the winters are extremely severe here. And bison are a migratory species. They have always migrated. They move from place to place with the seasons, with the availability of grass and forage. And the winter snows drive them down to lower elevation lands, which so happen to lie within the boundaries of Montana. And Montana has a zero tolerance policy against wild bison. The only time they allow them to even be in the state is so they can be hunted, which is a very, very disturbing thing in and of itself. But, bison are a migratory species. They need lower elevation habitat. That land is immediately right now in Montana, and we are trying to make way for bison so that they can roam on our public lands in Montana.
Stephanie, it seems incredible that, in a country which once had millions of these wild animals, that today, just as you said, under 3,000 remain. But in 2008 alone, 1,400 bison, nearly, half the number that have survived now, were captured and killed because of these so-called population measures to supposedly stop the spread of this disease to cattle, even though it wasn't the bison who brought the disease. So how much of our tax dollars are going towards doing this?
There is about $3 million dollars every year of U.S. tax money that is spent to appease Montana's livestock interests that kill American buffalo and harass American buffalo year after year. The plan will end up spending over $20 million in the next few years, and it's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous sum for a ridiculous purpose.
So what would happen if the government just stopped doing that? I mean, is that, first of all, Montana's hunters would have more animal to hunt, but then would it actually impact the cattle industry in any way in terms of access to grazing land? And if it does impact it, does your lawsuit account for setting aside land or setting aside more land other than just the protected parks for wild bison?
Well, we're talking about public land right now, and the cattle industry seems to think that they have the say so on who gets to use that public land. But you know, that land is supposed to be habitat for all native wildlife species, and so first and foremost, that's where we want to start, is for allowing bison to access those national forest lands outside of Yellowstone National Park. There are also a lot of private landowners that welcome bison, but the federal government and the state of Montana reject their private property wishes and instead cater to livestock interests.
Well, Stephanie, where can listeners find out more about the lawsuit?
BuffaloFieldCampaign.org.
BuffaloFieldCampaign.org is the website. Stephanie, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll keep track of the story.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having us.
Stephanie C. is the media coordinator for the Buffalo Field Campaign. We'll link to that website from our site later today at kpfk.org/uprising. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Robert Redford in the Yosemite National Park dedication in 1985 said, "I think the environment should be put in the category of our national security. Defense of our resources is just as important as defense abroad. Otherwise, what is there to defend? That's Robert Redford. That's Anadi's subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of the show after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. You can also find us at facebook.com/uprisingradio and twitter.com/uprisingradio. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.